Welcome back. This is Jeff Sachs of Atid and Web Yeshiva with another installment of our ongoing, seemingly endless trek through this long, important seventh chapter of The Lonely Man of Faith. I underestimated how long it would take us to get through it, although I do appreciate that last week we really managed to have a certain degree of interaction and back and forth, and I welcome that. And please feel free to speak up on the microphone, or or through the chat, so that we can hear your voices. Okay. Elpidio, where are you joining us from? Let me just look through the list. Okay. Here we are. Let's get through this seventh chapter, and then we will move on. Nashville, Tennessee. Okay. We had concluded the last section, again, re-emphasizing this idea of covenantal man reaching out, covenantal man being Adam II, the paradigm of humanity as portrayed in the second chapter of Bereshit, the conversation with God, the dialectic of prayer not so much as, like, there's the kind of prayer with a lowercase p and prayer with a capital P. Prayer with lowercase p, central and important as it is, the prayer act itself, what we call colloquially davening, either individually, a person standing someplace with a sitter, or preferably within the community of fellow worshipers in the synagogue, in a minyan. But either way, that act in and of itself is prayer with a lowercase p. Prayer with a capital P is this larger, more grandiose experience of communion with fellow man and with God as a fellow conversant in this kind of colloquy, the term that the Rav seems to enjoy so much, this dialogue, this conversation. Let us go further, he now says. Here we are on page, the bottom of page 66 in this edition that we're using. Let us go further. The existential insecurity of Adam II stems to a great extent also from his tragic role as a temporal being. The tragedy of being rooted in time, of existing in time with a beginning and an end, and that sense that we are rooted in time, that time is something which so frames our existence, which is so definitional to us as human beings. I think it was Woody Allen who said something along the lines of, I'm not afraid of death, I just don't want to be there when it happens. Well, that's, so much, with a comic twist, but says so much about who we are and how we try to go about our lives, knowing that there is some end out there. He simply cannot pinpoint his position within the rushing stream of time. He knows of endless pasts which rolled on without him. We know that there's this history, both the human history, which is seemingly endless, and the cosmic history. He is aware also of an endless future, which will rush on with no less force long after he will cease to exist. The link between the before, in which he was not involved, and the after, from which he will be excluded, is the present moment, which vanishes before it is experienced. In effect, the whole accidental character of his being is tied up with this frightening time consciousness. There's a passage in the Isha Halacha in the halachic man, where the Rav takes exception to, you know, what is apparently some kind of folk saying, avar ayin va'atid adayin v'hove keheref ayin, the past is gone, the future is not yet, the moment we live in now is like the blink of an eye. Da'aga minayin, so why worry? Don't worry, be happy. What was, what will be is not yet, and now is fleeting like the sands through an hourglass, so what are you worried about? And he takes, even though that aphorism was put to popular music not long ago by Mordechai Ben David or Avram Fried, I forget who, the Rav took exception to it and said, that's not a Jewish point of view. We believe in being very rooted in time, and the place that we are in time is very definitional to who we are. He began to exist at a certain point, the significance of which he cannot grasp, and his extent and his existence will end at another equally arbitrary point. Adam the second, covenantal man, experiences the transience and evanescence, the passing, the fleetingness of a now existence which is not warranted either by the before or by the after. Majestic man is not confronted with this time dilemma. Adam the first is not privy or not subject to the angst of time, of this kind of consciousness. The time with which he works, which Adam the first works, and which he knows, is quantified, spatialized, and measured, belonging to a cosmic coordinate system. Past and future are not two experiential realities. They just represent two horizontal directions. Before and after are understandable only within a framework of the causal sequence of events. Majestic man lives in micro units of clock time, with ease from now to now, completely unaware of a before and after, always living in the moment. I'll come back to that in a second. Everyone else is free to chime in answer to Elisa's question. Only Adam the second, to whom time is an all-enveloping personal experience, has to cope with the tragic and paradoxical implied in it. So, folks, what do you think about Elisa? What is the source of this awareness? So Elisa, I mean, she's asking a question, but I think she's telling us what perhaps she thinks. She asks, do you think that it's Adam the Second's connection to God's infinity that makes him feel the torment of a finite existence? Is that, are you, folks, are you in agreement with her guess here? What do you think? Let's do it. Let's take an up or down vote on that. Based upon what we've read, where do you think this awareness comes from? No? Who's online? Howard, Anna, Alan, what do you think? I mean, I think that there's, yeah, I think there's something to that. I think that that connection to the infinite creates a self-awareness which makes you sensitive to, you know, where you are in the cosmic chain. He goes on to say, in the covenantal community, meaning the relationship that Adam II has with fellow man and with God, The man of faith finds deliverance from his isolation in the now. For the latter contains both the before and the after. Every covenantal time experience is both retrospective, reconstructing and reliving the bygone, as well as prospective, looking ahead, anticipating the about to be. Let's go over that again. When you're a member of the covenantal community, you have this sensitivity to before, now, and after. And that experience of time is itself a covenantal experience. You look back, drawing on the past. That's what we talked about last time. That's what we talked about previously, about the discussion of why prayer is formulated as, is opens as this Elokei Avraham Yitzchak V'Yaakov, that we're calling on the past. We're placing ourselves in the present as part of this covenantal continuum, which reaches back to and has this awareness of the past. You know, where we're coming from is so very much at the forefront of how we view ourselves now. But it also is pointing towards the future. We pray, drawing on this, on the zchut of the past, drawing on our membership in the covenant as part of this ongoing community of the faithful, but it's very future-oriented. It's talking about redemption, it's talking about what will be, it's talking about how we'd like to see things in a more perfected frame, not now in the imperfect world we live in, but in one that we would envision for the future, hopefully the near future, if not, then for the more distant future. And that awareness is of looking back and looking forward, you know, which makes you both simultaneously very fixated on the now. You know, there are two types of people. There are people that, you know, like we'd say about them, oh, they live in the past, right? They can't move on. They're unaware of the present because they're living in the past. And then there are other people who are so busy running towards the future that they're oblivious to what's going on around them right now. But somehow having one anchor forward and one anchor backward creates an awareness of where you are at that particular moment. Imagine a tightrope walker. A tightrope walker is going to be very sensitive both to how far he is from the platform he's left and how far away he is from the platform that he's headed towards, and that the tension in keeping the balance makes you also very aware of, you know, the piece of cord or cable or tightrope that's under your feet wherever you are on the spectrum at that particular point. In retrospect, covenantal man re-experiences the rendezvous with God in which the covenant as a promise, hope, and vision originated in the past. In prospect, he beholds the full eschatological realization of this covenant. Eschatology, the end of days. In other words, we're reaching back to the past, the origins of the covenant. We're looking towards the future to Yimot HaMashiach, to redemption, to Geula. Let us not forget that the covenantal community includes the He who addressed himself to man, not only from the now dimension, but also from the supposedly already vanished past, from the ashes of a dead before. Rendezvous with God, a very interesting wording. Okay. Where was I? For all boundaries establishing before, now, and after disappear when God the Eternal speaks. God, of course, is beyond time. This is one of the Rambam's, one of the points the Rambam makes in the Hilchot Yesodei HaTorah, in the Mor Nevuchim, in the Guide to the Perplexed, that time itself is one of God's creations, and perhaps foreshadowing Einstein, the relationship between time and physicality, the relationship between time and the created world, time is something which measures the created world in the same way that length is something that measures physical objects. God, who exists outside of the realm of the created world, God who precedes the creation of the world, is not part of time. This is one of the manners in which the Rambam can answer the question, the philosophical question of free will and preordination and God's foreknowledge. If God knows what we're going to do in the future, so how can we truly be said that we have free will? If God knows whether we will or will not sin in the future, whether we will or will not stand up to the test in the future, so how can it be said that we have free will? The movie's already been recorded. All you have to do is press fast forward to find out how it's going to end. So one of the ways in which the Rambam addresses this question is to point out that that question is based upon a linear notion of time, which is irrelevant, which doesn't apply to God because he is beyond time. When we say that God is hu haya, hu hoveh, v'hu yihyeh, he was, he is, and he will be, it doesn't mean that the same way that I might say that I was hungry yesterday and I am hungry today and I will be hungry again tomorrow. Those are three distinct points on a time frame. When we say that God was haya, hoveh, v'yihyeh, was, is, and will be, it means simultaneously. He's simultaneously occupying all three time tenses at the same moment. He's riding above time. And that's why before, now, and after disappear when God, the Eternal, speaks. That's why we refer to him as the Eternal. Not just the Eternal that he will live forever, but that he always has been living. It's one of those things, that I have a young teenage son who has interests in, like a lot of young teenage kids, in science and in some of the elementals of physics. And we were watching something online the other night about physics and about space, about astrophysics and the origins of the planets and things like that. And it's one of those questions where you start thinking and it begins to hurt your brain a little bit. That idea of like where does space end? But also where does time end? That idea that if you shoot a missile out into space and it doesn't actually, knock into something else, it will go on forever. Well, that's how God is. He will go on forever, but unlike the metaphor of shooting the missile out into space, he has been going on forever, into the past. And that's an idea which is rather complex and hard for us to get our minds around. Within the covenantal community, not only contemporary individuals, but generations are engaged in a colloquy. And each single experience of time is three-dimensional, manifesting itself in memory, actuality, and anticipatory tension. Now, this is an idea hinted to here, which the Rav, which Rabbi Soloveitchik explored and came back to again and again. This notion of the symposium of the generations, that particularly when we are learning, particularly when we are engaged in Talmud Torah, Talmud Torah is an experience which draws us into the symposium of the generations. Very poetically, perhaps, Alan, if you can find it, we can put it up online as a recording of this talk. It would be interesting for you to hear Rabbi Soloveitchik's own voice. I think it's on the website 613, the numerals 613.org. It was a talk that he gave. It was a talk that he gave at a Pidyon Haben. And it was later written up, we'll try to find it, where he talked about the symposium of the generations. He says that when he sits down to learn, in his very poetic way, he opens the Gemara. He starts off by saying he's an old man. This was probably something that was recorded in the 1970s. So he was, you know, he was then in his 70s. Maybe it was 70, 75 years old, something like that. He says, "When I sit down to learn, I wonder what can I, how can I speak to my students? How can we overcome the generation gap?" Which was then, of course, a buzzword. "I come in, I'm not sure that I can do it. I'm sitting there with students, with young boys. Some of them are 60 years younger than me. And I open the Gemara, and suddenly the door opens. And in walks," and then he starts listing all of the Chachamim, the rabbis of the Mishnah, the rabbis of the Talmud, Rashi and Tosfot, the Rambam and the Ravid, the Ramban, all the way down to his own grandfather, Reb Chaim Brisker. And there's this symposium of the generations, and we're all in dialogue with each other. That's the kind of intentionally false historical memory, where we imagine asynchronous characters, figures who didn't live in the same generation, who didn't live in the same century, who lived sometimes thousands of years apart, in dialogue with each other, engaged through the text of the Torah, and that's what the Jewish experience is. On one hand, we're very conscious of this flow of time. On the other hand, we break it apart, that we can overcome it through this dialogue of the Masorah, of the tradition, of engaging in that. I'm looking at, Anna just posted this link to, these are all recordings of Rabbi Soloveitchik teach. Here it is, Uniting the Generations. Here's the link. If you right click on this link and save the file, you should be able to download it and listen to it on your own time. It's a little hard to listen to, both because of the quality of the tape and because if you're unfamiliar with Rabbi Soloveitchik's accent. But it's on this website, 613.org, and they have a section of recordings on the Rav, of the Rav's recordings, and it's a lecture called Uniting the Generations, Pidyon HaBen, which was delivered in 1974, so the Rav was 71 years old when he did it. So he said, if rabbinic figures, if students from the 20th century can be engaged with Rabbonim from the 2nd century, so it's not so hard to imagine overcoming the generation gap. And that idea is echoed here as well. Yes. This experiential triad, translated into moral categories, results in an awesome awareness of responsibility to a great past, which handed down the divine imperative to the present generation in trust and confidence, and also a commitment to the mute future, expecting this generation to discharge its covenantal duty conscientiously and honorably. Right? There's a lot of weight on our shoulders. It's the weight of being the link in the chain, in the proverbial chain. The best illustration of such a paradoxical time awareness, which involves the individual in the historic performance of the past and makes him also participate in the dramatic action of an unknown future, can be found in the Judaic Masorah community. The Masorah, the tradition, the chain of tradition. Masorah, meaning tradition, but from the same shoresh as Misira, to pass something down, like those advertisements for those fancy watches where they say you never really own one, you just guard it for the next generation. The latter represents not only a formal succession within the framework of a calendar time, but the union of the three grammatical tenses in an all-embracing time experience. When we accept our role and responsibility as a member of this community, it unites the past with the future, and we in the present as the conduit between the two. The Masorah community cuts across the centuries, indeed across the millennia, of calendric time, tick-tock, moving forward in one direction, and unites those who already played their part, delivered their message, acquired fame, and withdrew from the covenantal stage, quietly and humbly, with those who have not yet been given the opportunity to appear on the covenantal stage, and who wait for their turn in the anonymity of the about-to-be, the future unborn generations. And here, of course, he is waxing his most poetic. Thus, the individual member of the covenantal faith community feels rooted in the past and related to the future. The before and the after are interwoven in his time experience. He is not a hitchhiker. Unlike Majestic Man, unlike Adam the First, who like lives in the moment, who is very practical, pragmatic-oriented, Covenantal Man senses this sweep. Again, remember, Covenantal Man is very sensitive to the cosmos, to that awareness of the grandeur of that around him and what it means. In the same way, he has that same kind of sensitivity to time. But again, not just the time of the sand slipping through the hourglass, drawing us ever nearer to death, but time as the fabric that's uniting past with future, and we as the kind of the lens through which the now being the lens through which that motion is taking place, and what we do in the now either fulfills our responsibility between past and future, or God forbid, somehow warps that gentle matrix. Covenantal Man is not a hitchhiker suddenly invited to get into the swiftly traveling vehicle which emerged from nowhere and from which he will be dropped off into the abyss of timelessness, while the vehicle will rush on into parts unknown, continually taking on new passengers and dropping the old ones. Covenantal Man begins to find redemption from insecurity and to feel at home in the continuum of time and responsibility which is experienced by him in its endless totality. I'm going to skip ahead a drop. The great colloquy in which God himself participates with love and joy, right? That's what prayer is. Prayer is the conversation that kind of cuts across time, that starts off by the call to the past with the hope for the future. This act of revelation does not avail itself of universal speech, objective logical symbols or metaphors. The message communicated from Adam to Eve certainly consists of words. However, words do not always have to be identified with sound. It is rather a soundless revelation accomplished in muteness and the stillness of the covenantal community when God responds to the prayerful outcry of lonely man and agrees to meet him as brother and friend, while man in turn assumes the great burden, which is the price he pays for the encounter with God. God becomes in the Hasidic language, in the Kabbalistic language, God shrinks himself to engage us in conversation. those of you that joined us before Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur for that series on Agnon, recall Agnon's beautiful metaphor of being a little boy and going to shul on Yom Kippur and imagining God like a grown-up, the way a grown-up will bow down, will make himself small in order to, you know, turn his ear to listen to what the little boy has to say. Little boy, knee-high to his father, is standing on his tippy-toes trying to speak to him, and Abba bows down, leans down, crouches down in order to hear what his son is saying to him. That as a kind of visual metaphor for how our prayer works. We reach up to the heavens, and God, as it were, bows down to hear what we have to say. But if God is willing to, kaviyochel, be mitzamtzem himself, there I'm not speaking in the technical jargon of the Kabbalah of what that meant, simtzum, although there's a connection. So we also take on a responsibility. We can't be children forever. We've taken on a responsibility because we've become responsible for the covenant, and that's a burden. That's a burden that we have to pay in order to have that encounter, in order to have that conversation. Thus ends the important seventh chapter about prayer. Now, what's important about this chapter is the scope of what he's done here. It is such a innovative, fresh take on the role of prayer in Jewish life, on what it means to be in communion and in dialogue with God, what that means for God, what that means for us, what it means for us as conversants with God, and what it means for us as members of a prayerful community. It's a very, very different take on Jewish prayer than a lot of what we're used to. You'll notice, well, you tell me, we've just spent, I don't know, 4 weeks going through this chapter. What were some of the salient characteristics of how he views prayer? What struck you as being unique? What was significant for its near absence? What are some of the things that are not there in the way that are usually present when we're talking about Jewish prayer? Sometimes to the exclusion of other topics. When you say it's more conversational, Sherry, you mean it's that prayer is more conversational? Mm-hmm. Right. Community, yeah, the importance of community, but not community in the sense of, you know, like why it's important to get 10 people to show up for Minyan, you know, which is often the, you know, the extent of conversation about the communal element of prayer. But it's prayer as a conversation that comes out of a group of people that are members of a covenant. Transcendental connection, is that? I think that's what you meant. Yeah. Yeah. close connection between what? Between man and God, Sherry. Yeah, although that's something that, you know, we might see in lots of other writings on prayer. There's almost no discussion of bakasha, of the requests that we make. We think of prayer very often as, you know, this laundry list of bakashot, of requests, of give us health, give us wealth, give us wisdom, give us etc. That's all. Now, there are other places that Rabbi Soloveitchik talks about prayer. I've mentioned to you, there's a volume, a collection of his essays in English on prayer called Worship of the Heart. It was one of the posthumous volumes that was put together, a very good, very important volume that rounds out some more of his writings on prayer. But the notion of prayer as our laundry list of needs and requirements it does not occupy a central place here. It's an element of prayer, to be sure. We don't deny that. But that's again prayer with a lowercase p, and not to, thanks for Alan, thanks for that link to that book. But that's prayer with a lowercase p. That's the mechanics of how prayer works, but it's not what prayer is. What the difference between the outer mechanics and the inner experience, this is a description of the inner experience. I mean, somebody could read this chapter, and you know, like the example I give an alien lands from Mars and picks up only one book to find out what Judaism is all about. And then, you know, we would ask him, okay, so describe to us, what does Jewish prayer look like? How does it work? They would probably really get it wrong just based upon this description, because this is much more descriptive of the inner spiritual moment and challenge and encounter and conversation and colloquy and covenant, and almost not at all about the mechanics and details of prayer, besides this one lengthy second endnote here about the connection between Kriyat Shema versus the Amidah and the Smichat Gula Latzvila, etc. But that's, you know, largely relegated to this endnote. Sherry points out that Rabbi Sachs, Rabbi Jonathan Sachs, the other Rabbi Sachs, of Great Britain, has this series on the parasha called Covenant and Conversation. I'm not sure what the etymology or the origin of that title is, but it's certainly catchy phrases. So these are some of the salient points that Rabbi Soloveitchik draws out on prayer, but prayer as the epitome of what B'nai Brit, what members of the covenantal community in dialogue with God do. And this takes on a central role in this work, because we're trying to understand the personality of Adam II. We're trying to understand what it means for someone to overcome the loneliness, the isolation, and to enter dialogue. Adam with Eve, Adam with the community of other lonely men of faith, and then together with God. So if you're trying to describe that conversation, that relationship, so then you have to understand, well, what do these people do? Well, they converse. And that conversation, the great conversation, the grand conversation, the Jewish conversation, is a prayerful conversation. So that's why this topic takes such a central role in the work. We're going to cut it short a little bit this evening, although I'm happy to stay on and you know, listen to your thoughts or comments or questions. Next week, we'll move ahead to the eighth chapter, and from that point, it's really we're within sight of the end. So I'll sign off now. Happy to hear your thoughts and reactions to the work we've done these last few weeks in this chapter.